Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Michael Shelley here, and my guest this week is Billy Bremner, a guy whose career I followed for a long time because he's one of my all-time favorite guitar players. I came to know him through his work in the band Rockpile, mostly backing up Dave Edmunds and Nick Lowe on their albums. Eventually, they did, because of contractual reasons, they were not able to record under their own name. Eventually, they did make one Rockpile album, which I totally love. And then I found out that Billy had a long solo career. It continues to this day from his home base in Sweden. But he also had a career as a session guitar player. And he's got such a unique style on the guitar. And it's very interesting, his skill of being able to put that style into a lot of different musical situations. That's a real interesting and unique ability to do that. So he's got that, and it just makes him real interesting as a musician and collaborator. He's supposed to be in the United States right now doing a tour that was canceled due to COVID. He'll be back in November 2022, so you've got that to look forward to. I did want to point out that there are some technical problems in this interview. Totally my fault and not up to the audio standards that I like to have on this podcast, so forgive me for that. You and Billy both deserve better, but I cleaned it up as best as I could, and I think the interview is interesting enough that you can still enjoy it. Also, there are some curses in this interview, so if hearing the S or F bombs offends you, go listen to what went out over the air. That's available over at wfmu.org/Michael. There's no curses in that version, but coming up here in the podcast version, you will hear just a few curses here. So, very interesting guy, very humble, very matter of fact, very dry, and I found this very interesting. Of course, like I said, one of my all-time favorite guitar players, so no complaints from me. Hope you enjoy it. Talk to you soon. Thanks. Well, welcome. I'm excited to speak to you. You are one of my favorite guitar players. So let's start with that. When did somebody put a guitar in your hand? How did you learn to play guitar? And was your style there as a kid, or is it something you developed? Where does it come from?
Well, it's a thing of just practicing and playing over the years and listening to nearly everyone humanly possible that plays guitar. That's all I ever did as a kid, listen to like some even jazz at that age, and no one was into that. So, but I listened to everything, and then I taught myself, and just I don't know, came up with my own thing, I suppose. That's the only way I can put it.
Yeah, fair enough. It is certainly your own thing. I think you grew up in Aberdeen, Scotland. Were your parents musical? Did they listen to the radio? Did they have a record player?
No, my dad played ukulele. That was. He used to play a lot at the. He was the life and soul of the party, let's put it that way, of all the relatives' parties. And I thought the ukulele was extremely boring. But anyway, he was very entertaining and pretty good at it. So, but he was the only one that played. My mom didn't play anything.
So you're a few years younger than the guys in the Beatles, so I assume you sort of got hit with the, you know, the 1950s rockers and then exposed to the Beatles, and those two things must have influenced you heavily, I assume?
Yeah, but you must remember something. When I was young, I mean, I didn't have the opportunity to have, like, to listen to records and stuff. Well, we didn't have a record player when I was small in the olden days. Like I said, I just used to listen to my old man playing, and that was it. I remember the first record I ever got was the first Beatles album.
And did you figure out all the songs on the guitar?
Yeah, but that's no problem. I have a good ear.
Ah. So what was your first instrument? What guitar did someone buy for you?
I have no idea. I know my cousin had a really crappy, like a semi-acoustic guitar, and that was called an Egmont. And I know the strings were about like 2 inches off the fretboard. It was like practically impossible to play. But I know that I started off with that guitar, and I used to tune it to my own tuning for the first 2 years, and then was told how to tune it properly, and I had to start again.
That's incredible. So when is the first time that the idea of, hey, maybe I'll start, or, you know, try to be part of a rock and roll band, when did that enter your head, or was that always there?
There was a couple of bands already, well, formed already in Aberdeen, and well, through word of mouth, because I was just playing kind of rhythm guitar then, just the chordy guy. And then I got offered to play with a couple of bands, and I started off like that, and then progressed into playing more lead stuff. And it was just a progression thing over the years, and slow but sure.
You started at a certain point. You joined the Louvers, who had been Lulu's backup band, and then you started to.
Yeah, but never. I was never in that band when they played with Lulu. It was just the Lovers, and I joined them after they and Lulu split up. They asked me to join them because their guitar player left. So, but I never played with Lulu. Just the Lovers. That was the name of the band.
Okay. It's funny. I always said Louvers, but it's Lovers. So then you ended up playing on the record March Hare with Colin Hare's solo record, which I love that record. I'm a huge Honeybus fan. How did you hook up with him? Had you moved to London?
No, we were with the same agency. Their manager and I. I can't remember. Again, it's going so far back. And I know that I played on a couple of their recordings, and Pete Kircher, the drummer, was also the drummer in the band that I played with. And so I knew Pete, so that's how I knew Honeybus.
Yeah, Honeybus.
Yeah. I Can't Let Maggie Go.
Yeah. Such a great record. Yeah.
Yes.
I think they were much more a thing in the UK than in the US.
Oh, I'm sure they were.
Eventually, you become a member of this band Fatso with Neil Innes, which becomes part of the Rutland Weekend television series, which was Eric Idle's first project after Monty Python. It seems like it was quite fun being part of that. You're playing guitar and you're, you know, rubbing shoulders with George Harrison and all these people. And it just seems like fun. It seems like you've kind of got a natural sense of humor. Seems like it must have been great days.
Yeah, it was, but again, Neil Innes and Neil was in that show, and we were in it every now and then, only because we were working with Neil. The Christmas show that George Harrison was on, I know that we were on that, but it was a good program. But we only guested every now and then on that thing. And like I said, anything that Neil Innes was involved in, we were. So anything musical, like the original Ruttles, they did the album quite a while later. We were the original Ruttles before they actually recorded anything.
Yeah, I think if you go on YouTube, you can see clips of the original Ruttles recordings from that television show, and you're featured on guitar on those. But you're not on the LP when they finally went to make that?
No, absolutely not. No, I don't know why they had. I don't know. There was some reason that they had studio musicians instead of the band that we had together then. I don't know why. I still don't know, but I didn't think about it too much. It was their choice. So
there's two records that were produced by Chris Ife. He was a guest on this show, and he seems like he was sort of a ambitious guy. Always had his fingers in a lot of things. Always trying to reinvent himself. Tell me about the expectation for those, and why you recorded them as Bill Murray, not as Billy Bremner.
Oh, listen, you know that is so long ago, and there's one very simple answer. Because Billy Bremner. There was a famous Scottish football player called Billy Bremner, and he was a hard little player. He played for Leeds United, and he was hated by everyone. So instead of classing myself as the singing footballer, I just used my middle name to to this, because every time I used the name Billy Bremner, people used to come up and ask me, why have you given up football, blah, blah, blah. I never had. But the good thing was that Bremner in America, they didn't know who Billy Bremner, the football player, was. So there was no problem over in the States, only in the UK.
And working with Chris Eif, was he good to work with?
Yeah, Chris was a personal friend. We did a few, like beginning of my recording career, he did all my demos up in a studio that was run by two publishers, and that I was signed to, same as Chris Eif. But these were, I never thought anyone would ever hear any of them. But, they've resurfaced and, they were right at the beginning. That was my starting thing in the studio with recording and writing songs, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, there's a CD called Singled Out, and if folks want to hear all that early stuff, it's all been compiled on there.
Oh, my God.
I don't know
about this record.
There's some wonderful stuff on there, Billy. Take my word for it. So how did Dave Edmonds find you? How did that connection get made?
I was playing with Fatso in a place called a great pub in London called the Nashville Room. It was one of my favorite places to play. Great, big high stage in Mendes and good sound. Anyway, and Dave and Nick Lowe came along one night and because they were going to form this band together with Terry Williams, which was an old friend of Dave's, and they asked me if I would make up the foursome. And that's the whole story. They were pretty impressed by what they heard, so they asked me if I would join and form a band with them, and that was a rock pile.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing that there was no more to it than that there was no scientific experiment or something, because when you and Dave, when the four of you play together, it really is one of those rare bands that's more than the sum of his parts. I mean, every four of you, each of you is amazing, but yet together you're even more. So there was a perfect chemistry between the way Dave sort of played the monkey Chuck Berry shuffle thing and the way you kind of added your stuttery,
you have two totally different styles of guitar players in the same band that actually it just fit for some reason. I mean, we never got in, there was no playing over anyone. It was like him or me playing at one time. It just worked perfectly. And with the vocals as well, between me and Dave and Nick, that worked out. It was just a pleasure and a great band to work with, that band.
Yeah, I agree with you completely that you are two different guitar styles. Can you break it down a little bit, how someone who's listening would hear, what the difference between what your guys' approach would be?
Dave is very noisy and I'm very quiet.
That's
really
interesting.
Dave is, let's put the amp up on number 11, absolutely. And I was the exact opposite. I would just get the sound that I wanted and then hear myself through the monitors if need be and let Dave do his own thing. And it just worked out absolutely fine. That's the only difference I know. Dave used to play extremely loud, which was fine.
When it came time to make the records and to divvy up who played the guitar solos, I mean, I know Dave was used to playing all the instruments himself, up in Wales, shuttered up in Rockfield or whatever. Would you sort of each take a shot at it and then you'd see which one fit the best, or did Dave or Nick
No, it was like, long before the only Rock Pile album, there was other albums that Nick made and Dave made that Rock Pile was on. And it was like the same kind of lineup for about five or six albums between them. And it was like whatever we rehearsed up, whatever new song came up, it just, whatever I played, just it fitted with whatever Dave was playing. There was no questions asked. We just went ahead and did it. It was just, and it all came out like, it's like something like you wouldn't, it's like a fairy tale, really. But it was real, and it just worked. And it was the only time in my playing life that I'd ever seen or heard anything fit together so quick, without any rehearsal, without any talk, without any whatever adjustments you want to do. It just fit. That was it. Mm. From day one, from rehearsal one, I'll never forget it.
Ah, that's really mind-blowing. Yeah, so the results were the tracks on Wax record, the Repeat When Necessary record, a little bit of twang on Jesus of Cool, a little bit of Pure Pop for Now People, and Labor of Lust, certainly. And I think you play on some later stuff of Nick's. And then you guys sort of became a band of choice to kind of knock stuff out, Carlene Carter and Mickey Jupp and all these other records, because you could just, like you said, the chemistry was there, and it's kind of amazing. Amazing. Tell me about Trouble Boys, is a song that you wrote that Dave ended up doing. Tell me about songwriting. Is it something you were doing a lot back then? Something that came easy? Something that came hard? How was that song written?
That's back to Chris Ive. Way before Rock Pile started, I was writing songs. And like I said, the people that when I recorded, when Chris Ive recorded me vocally doing my own song, remember, that was in the studio of the publishers that we were with. So I was with these publishing guys, Heath Levy Music, for years. And that's where I did all my early recordings. And that's all I can think about, really. That's all I can say.
But do you remember, did a song like that take you 5 minutes or a day or a week to finish?
Oh, no. Trouble Boys just came into my head. And I just put it down and recorded the demo, which I still think my demo is, the best version of that song has been recorded. And there's quite a few people have done it, like Thin Lizzy and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, we heard the demo earlier in the show. So, I grew up in the New York City area, and those records, those Dave and Nick and the Rock Pile album, were on the radio, just constantly here. And they were certainly kind of musicians' favorites as well. When you guys started, because when I've talked to Nick about this, and he sort of says that the whole beauty of Rock Pile is that there was no, you barely rehearsed, and that it was just fun. And but were there also expectations? Was there also a hope that we'll have some hit records, or was it just a lark?
No. It's like I said to you before. This is one of the only bands that I can, or even setups that I can think of, we didn't rehearse a lot. Well, we didn't have to. We just, every time a new song came up, whatever we were, if we were getting some songs together for recording, we would just go in, rehearse them, and it would just end up absolutely naturally. I played whatever part I thought was right, and Dave did the same. Terry did his thing, and Nick did his. And it just, that's what I said before, it just all fitted, and it's hard to describe and hard to explain.
Yeah, I guess what I'm asking is, was the band ambitious on top of that chemistry?
Absolutely not. No, because anything that happened, like when Dave went to number two in the charts with Girls Talk, mind you, that was, let me see, I think it was the Irish band, I Don't Like Mondays, they were at number one, and Dave couldn't get to number one because of that record. I don't know, man. I think it was that. Anyway, it was that Irish band from years ago. Anyway, no, there was no. I mean, when the record was released, that wasn't our job. Our job was to record. The record company, they did what they wanted with whatever tracks. We wouldn't even be asked. And then whatever success, then great. I mean, fine, but it was no. No, like expectation. No, oh, let's hope, and or I think this is going to be better. Blah blah blah. There was none of that.
Gotcha. One of the great moments in rock pile history is during the Campuchia concert film and album where you guys do Little Sister with Robert Plant. That's a very easy clip to watch on YouTube. And there's a wonderful moment in there where you take Dave takes a guitar solo, then you take a guitar solo, and you can see Dave kind of smiling at you because you kind of go, you just do this wonderful sort of ending of your solo. Did you guys rehearse that with Robert Plant? Was that just off the cuff?
No, no, we must have gone through it with him, but again, it's everyone knew the song, so it was just like, what key do you do it in? And okay, let's go through it. And who does a solo here? You do it. Okay, blah, solo there, and we ended. Blah blah blah, and that was it.
Yeah. It's quite wonderful. I mean, it really is great. There is a certain thing where, like, I always describe Rockpile as sort of just having an on-off switch. You know, there's no dials for subtlety. You know, it's just you turn it on and it goes, and it just kind of steamrolls anything in the way. You know, let's talk about Terry as a drummer. I mean, very, very special drummer. Nobody plays like him.
Well, I'd never heard of Terry. I'd heard maybe the name Mann. Which they were very popular, especially in California, the Mann Band, Mann. And when Nick and Dave asked me to join, they told me who Terry was and who he played with. But until then, in fact, I must admit, I didn't know who Nick was either. I knew Dave, but that was it. And I know that Nick recorded Dave, but that was it. And as far as Terry was concerned, the first time we met, and the first day we rehearsed, it was like, hello, I'm how are you, blah, 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 blah. And then boom, that was it.
That's genius. But as a drummer, right, you'd never heard anyone play like him, I assume.
No, I mean, Terry was Terry, and it's a tragic that he can't play anymore.
Because of contractual reasons, Rockpile wasn't allowed to record as Rockpile, but only as Dave or Nick. But finally, that was all worked out, and you guys made the Seconds of Pleasure LP, and you, Billy, got to sing a couple of songs, Heart and You Ain't Nothing But Fine, which were really two of the most played songs on the record. Was that, and I loved that record. I think that's as good as anything you guys ever did. Were you happy to finally get a little bit of the spotlight on you, and are you happy with that album?
No, none of us were. None of us actually really liked that album very much. It was, I don't know. It compared to some of the other things that we had done, it was just, I don't know, it didn't sound Rockpile-y. And that's really hard to explain as well. Obviously, some of the tracks are absolutely fine. But the whole thing, as a finished thing, I don't know, it just didn't hit the spot with us. Even though I must say one thing, when I've listened over the years, a couple of times every now and then I'll hear bits here and there, it sounds a lot better now than it did then.
Because to me, it sounds like the natural evolution of Rockpile. You know, you can't just do the same thing over and over again. It's a little more pop. It's a little more refined.
Exactly.
But
well, I know one thing. Dave thought that there was too many poppy things. In fact, maybe all of us did. Maybe that's why. I'm not quite sure, but it's like I know that we didn't. We weren't very ecstatic about that album. You're right. I mean, everything. There's some really good things on it, but I mean, and I think it's well played, it's well sung, well arranged. It's just it didn't have the bite. That's what we thought, anyway.
I guess I hear what you mean, but I love it regardless. Were you happy with the way Heart turned out, and You Ain't Nothing But Fine?
I've never ever liked that song.
You Ain't Nothing But Fine. Where did it? Who unearthed it?
We got that from the Thunderbirds. Because they were opening for us on some European tour, and they had that song, and we all thought it goes down so well with the crowd, and we thought, well, we'll do it, because, I mean, they got it from someone else as well. It wasn't their song.
Yeah.
So we decided to do it, but again, it's for some reason it goes down a storm with the public, but again, it's not exactly my cup of tea.
How interesting. And what about Heart? I think Nick's demo of that is more like a reggae thing. How did it get turned into the pop masterpiece that we know from Rockpile?
Well, again, it was just, remember, Nick hadn't recorded the reggae-type version. He just came in with the song into the rehearsals, and then we just listened to it and arranged it as we went along.
No big deal.
Absolutely not. At the time, even though it sounds like it was pretty well arranged, it was, the band was so good that we just, whatever was in front of us, we did it, and we did it our way without even thinking.
Yeah. You're blowing my mind. There's a documentary called Born Fighters, which is on YouTube, and it sort of it films the band, mostly when you're making, I think, Repeat When Necessary and Labor of Lust. Have you seen that recently?
No, not recently.
It's
for a long, long time.
I think you're in Eden Studios, and it looks like it's like 30 degrees below zero. You're wearing like winter coats and
oh, that thing. Oh, yeah. I've got my furry leather jacket on.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, no, it was pretty chilly.
It's kind of amazing that those records...
And also, that's when you could smoke in the studio as well.
Yes, everybody seems to have that. A pint of beer and a cigarette. Dave has a cigarette.
Absolutely. That was Rockpile. I mean, there you go. That was part of the thing. That was our card, you might say.
Having a little liquid refreshment?
No, let's put it this way. Unlike a lot of bands, we socialized a lot together. We were good pals off stage. So if ever one would say to the other, well, let's meet up in the pub, we would all show up. It was just like good buddies having a pint together. And that would happen a lot in London, a lot. So it wasn't like a lot of bands where you go your own way after you come off stage.
Gotcha. That's a wonderful chemistry. So when it ended, I mean, I know that Dave has a reputation of being a little bit of a cantankerous guy, and I know that there were business problems. Was it, you know, disappointing to you, who was not really in the middle of that, that the band sort of eventually...
Yeah, but, I mean, there was, I think, the reason that it all ended was because Nick, remember, we were managed by... Well, not in writing, but by Jake Riviera, who always managed Nick. And Dave and Jake did not get on. So that was one of the reasons why we didn't stay together.
And how did you feel about that? Were you disappointed?
Absolutely. I was always disappointed. Every time we come back from America, any time we tour there, we come back and we say, well, that's it. Thanks, lads. That was great. Good time. See you whenever. And then we would get back together again before long. So we all thought it was like breaking up at the end of each tour, but we didn't.
That's so odd. Yeah, you guys did a lot of touring in America, a lot of touring, and a lot of opening for, I know Blondie and some bands like that, some bigger bands. Were there ever mismatches? Were you guys ever on a bill with someone where it just didn't work out?
Well, yes, we did actually kind of blow some artists off the stage before they got on. I mean, no, and I'm not being big-headed about this, but it's right. I mean, we opened up for, I can't remember how many people. I know we opened up on, I think it was four major tours with four major artists, and we would pretty well... make it very difficult for them following us. Well, not intentionally, but just because it was so good and so well appreciated.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's kind of a good feeling. And let's talk about Loud Music in Cars, a great single that came out by you, lyrics by Will Birch. Did in that kind of situation, does Will just hand you the lyrics on a piece of paper and you go off and write the melody?
No. I was going through... some lyrics that he had that he wasn't very happy with. He didn't think they were worth a lot. That I went through everything, and that was one of the songs I picked out. And I said, well, I'll do something with this because it's very simple, and it should be. If I put a nice simple melody to this with a nice feel, I like this. So that was that.
Ah, terrific record. So Rockpile breaks up and you are, you know, hustling a little bit, getting studio gigs, and you play on a ton of records in that time, including 1982, Back on the Chain Gang. It's such a classic guitar part. I mean, it's so you, and yet it fits in the record so well, and it's just beautiful. When you did it, was there any, you know, did you go in the studio and think, oh, well, I've really done something that people are going to just, you know, listen to forever?
No, it was, again, it was a very good producer, Chris Thomas.
Mm.
And I had known the Pretenders for quite a long time. I mean, years before, Nick used to go out with Chrissy. And so they were a couple for a while. I mean, and Jim Honeyman Scott was a real good personal friend of mine. So when Jim went and there was two of the guys in that band died.
Yeah.
When Jim went, and then they were thinking, we got this record. What should we do? Well, let's get Billy. So they asked me to do it. And then, I'm quite pleased with that record, actually. Some of the riffs are, there's a lot of people still say to me, oh, that's really nice playing, good ideas, blah, blah, blah. So I'm proud of that record.
I hope so. Yeah, it's just amazing. Is that something that took all day or 10 minutes or how, you know?
Oh, I have no idea. I can't remember. I know I could. I mean, that the riff. I mean, I played it just out of my head. And it just, maybe not exactly the same, but very similar. And they said, well, this works. So let's work on this. So I'm obviously I got it so that I could play it through the whole song, and there's a couple of chordy things in there as well that are really nice if you're not listening you might miss, but they're really little accents on the chords as well as the lead part. So like I said, I'm proud of that record.
Yeah, it's a great record. There's some parts in there that, like I said, are very Billy Bremner-ish, those kind of and I hate to hum this, but those those kind of where you're pulling out these chords, yeah, slightly against yep. the rhythm. Yeah, that's all you, as far as I'm concerned, yeah.
Yeah.
And then your first album, Bash, came out in, I think, 84, and you wrote a bunch of the songs, but there's also people, Elvis Costello songs and the guys from Squeeze, and there was some, you know, I love that record. Again, are you happy with that?
No. No, I'm one of them guys that's like, to be honest, well, especially back in them days, I mean, it all sounded fine at the time, but then when it was finished, and then if you, because I don't very often listen to what I've done, but I mean, you have to after you just finish a record just to make sure everything's okay. And I it was okay at the time, but after a while, I thought it could have been quite a bit better. Mind you, I don't think you'd be a very good musician if you didn't think otherwise.
Gotcha. Okay, great.
I think everyone in their own way is kind of, as well as being happy with what they've got, thinking, I wish I could blah, 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 even though it's fine.
Yeah, always striving to do better. I guess that makes sense. Just for a minute, let's talk about guitars and amps and stuff. I know that in Rockpile, you played a bunch of different guitars. It seemed like you were playing, is it a Hammer guitar for much of the time?
Hammer,
I'm sorry. But I've seen you with, you know, Gibsons, with Fenders. Are you a guitar nut or not that important to you?
No, when I got my Hammer, I mean, I remember me and Dave were given one each by Hammer from Chicago. And I used mine for a long time in Rockpile after I was given that guitar. Yeah, the only time there was any other guitars is just for a change of sound on the stage, but that was very few and far between. If I started with one guitar on stage, I played it for the whole evening.
Hmm.
So, and that hammer was one of my favorites at the time. It weighed a ton.
Yeah.
It was like one of them Gibson Black Beauties. Fucking hell. I mean, it was like a lawnmower around your neck. It's terrible.
Aye. Where's that guitar nowadays?
No idea. I know I swapped it because I very, very rarely sold anything. I usually swapped it for something. 90%, 99%.
Well, that's interesting.
Unless someone absolutely desired something and offered to buy it a few times, and then I said, okay. It wasn't through, like, the wish just to sell it. But I would much rather get something else that I would maybe enjoy playing. So, especially acoustics. So, but anyway, I have no idea where any of the old guitars are. No idea whatsoever.
Interesting. We've sort of covered your life, you know, in music since you were a literal teenager. Was there any point in all of this time where you had to go take a job doing something else besides playing guitar?
Don't mention that word.
A job?
Yes.
Okay.
No, I wrote a song called Get a Job. And it's like three little words are going to drive you insane. And that's what I always thought about a job. That's why I was a musician, so I didn't have to get a job. No, because my mom and dad and everyone used to say to me, what's your real job? I said, this is my fucking real job. What do you think? I mean, I'm a professional. They say, never, what do you really do? I don't do anything else. I mean, everyone thinks you should be a fucking, I don't know, a plumber or a carpenter or something. But I was nothing. I just played guitar all the time. I mean, I went to night school when I left school to learn a few different trades. But I never went far enough to do any of them. I only did it for, I think it was 2 years of a five-year course. And then I left just to play full-time professionally.
Oh, good for you. In the 90s, you moved to Sweden, you went to Sweden to work with this band called The Refreshments, who really were so into that rock pile sound and sort of trying to update it.
Absolutely.
And then did you just end up staying because you liked it? What happened? Because that's where you are right now.
Well, absolutely. Well, I'd been in Sweden, I don't know how many times before that. And I thought, well, I got the offer to go over and... the original idea was to produce the band, which I did. I produced the first two albums, I think it was. But then I would go back. But then the third time I came, I decided to stay because I had no ties. I had no, family. Well, I had family, but they were grown up kids. So, I thought, well, fuck it, take a chance and stay over here for a while. And then I've been here ever since.
And you love it?
I mean, it's the same as anywhere. It's got its ups and it's got its downs, absolutely. I mean, Sweden can be pretty boring. But I was living in Stockholm. It's such a great city. That was wonderful. I wish I was back there. But for convenience and what all the stuff I was doing, I had to come up to this town called Gävle, which is very near where I am now, and this is where I've been for quite a long time. But when I lived in Stockholm, it was a fantastic place. I love it there. I love to play there, I love to visit, and I really love staying there. So,
are you still learning? Are you still picking up tricks on the guitar?
Absolutely. You never, ever, ever stop learning. No one. And that's the good thing about it, especially in the studio. And, well, hopefully I'll be going back in again. I hope all this stuff ends soon so I can get back to normal.
What is it about these songs? Because your new project is called Rock Files. What is it about these songs, these recordings, that have made them so enduring that people now, you know, this many years later, still want to hear them? What do you think it is?
I don't know. It's like saying, the corny old saying, the people's music. It's like music that just comes out of us and it seems to grasp whoever hears it. So it's not like, I know who that is. I know the sound of that band, like Status Quo or blah, blah, blah. It's not like that. It's just like, I don't know, absolutely pleasing to the ears, and we knew it, and we knew how to do it.
I agree. I mean, I think it's a combination of the, just, it's, yeah, it's just chemistry that is sort of very undeniable. Do you have a favorite tune or two from those days?
I'll tell you one thing. Dave's recording, and this is long before Rockpile got together, of I Hear You Knocking is still one of my favorites. Brilliant feel on that record. And it's not Dave playing the lead either.
It's not what?
It's not Dave playing that.
Oh.
That's not Dave.
Who is it?
It's a guy called Mickey G.
Oh, okay.
A Welsh guy, one of Dave's old pals. Great guitar player. He used to be Tom Jones' guitar player. That was him. Because I always thought it was Dave until I found out it was Mickey G. But like I said, Dave's vocal on that, his rhythms on it, the whole feel of that recording. It's absolutely, I'll never forget the first time I heard I Hear You Knocking by Dave. I was absolutely floored. When he, and also, when it comes to the chorus, and it comes out, it's got that kind of slap delay only on the chorus vocals. Brilliant. Like an old Elvis-sounding thing. Absolutely great.
I mean, it is amazing that you were in a band with two of the greatest record producers ever, you know?
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
That is true. You know, it seems like without music, I can't imagine what you would have done with your life or in your life. Or has it brought you, I mean, are you a happy person? Is that a fair question? Are you, has it brought you sort of
this is a paid hobby.
So you feel lucky.
There's not a lot of people in this world absolutely love their job. I do.
Yeah.
Because it's different every night. I can play something different every night, unlike a lot of people who go to work and don't have the opportunity to do that.
You know, thank you for spending some time with us. I, you know, you play on so many of my favorite records. It's just
thank you.
Just a total pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.